Hello and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very happy that you're here with me today. It is such a joy for me to do this podcast. I'm privileged to speak with people who are out in the world making a difference with their day jobs, their programs, their art, their activism. If you would like to support me in doing this work, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by becoming a member of my Patreon community. You can go to patreon.com/OmkariWilliams and sign up. There's also a link on my website, OmkariWilliams.com. My guest today, Alicia Montero, is a social justice advocate and a dedicated member of the SE Justice Group, a Black feminist organization that supports and uplifts the experiences and solutions of women with incarcerated loved ones. Alicia is a prison abolitionist who believes that there is a very different, much more humane way to respond to the consequential actions that hurt people. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Alicia to the podcast. Hi, Alicia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am really well. I've been looking forward to this conversation because it feels to me like such an important thing to talk about. So I want to start by talking about what SE Justice does, because SE Justice addresses a very specific and truly heartbreaking problem, which is the fallout on women, particularly Black and Brown women, of the United States mass incarceration system. And if you could talk about how this organization came into existence so people have some context, that would be great.
Sure. Yes. And I agree. It's a very important issue and one that is not looked at too often. And SE is amazing. So it was founded by Gina Clayton Johnson, who's an amazing woman. And she started as a youth organizer for NAACP and a civil rights activist in South Los Angeles. That led her to become an attorney. She went to Harvard Law School. And at that time, she had a friend of hers that was sentenced to 20 years in prison. So then that kind of changes things, right? You start to understand better how the system works and how it not only impacts the people on the inside, but it greatly impacts the people on the outside. She started practicing in Harlem, New York, and she was seeing a lot of the fallout from people going to prison and Black women in particularly having these financial hardships based on convictions that they really had nothing to do with. And this started her mind going, and it led her to starting SE Justice Group, SE named after her great-grandmother. And as far as I can tell, it's never been looked at before, right? So you have this issue with this mass incarceration of our Black and Brown men, and the people at home are forgotten about. There's one in every four women has an incarcerated loved one, and almost one in every two Black women have an incarcerated loved one. And this continues this system of mass incarceration. It's a cycle. It's a perpetual cycle. And you advocate to abolish the prisons, you're advocating for those people inside and you're advocating for the women outside who are holding down the fort.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I do think that when we think about people being incarcerated, we really do tend to limit it to the incarcerated individual and not think about the impact that that has, the ripples that are there. And you have a very personal story of your own experience with this. Would you share some of that with us?
Sure. Yes, of course. So I got involved in SE Justice Group in the first place because my husband is incarcerated. He is in prison on a 7 years to life sentence, which he is now in his 21st year. So this is very personal to me. And I advocate every single day from the moment I wake up to the minute I go to sleep to one, get him home. And also, I am very aware of what's happening inside. And I'm very aware of what it's doing to the people on the outside. Incarceration is so isolating for those at home. I am in a position where I'm advocating every day and I'm meeting people through that work. But this isn't a normal thing. This is not how people usually function when somebody goes to prison. It's very shocking. and it's very isolating, and you can't tell the people that you work with, and you can't tell your friends, and you can't tell some of your family, and you're alone. And that is how I started out. I started out very alone. And then somebody actually nominated me to join SE Justice Group, and I joined one of their healing cohorts for 9 weeks. And it was amazing. And I was surrounded by these women who just needed a place to come together and talk and be open. And I'm in a really different world now where I can speak on it, and there is no shame. I am not ashamed at all that my husband is in prison. He's one of many, many Black and Brown people that are in prison. There is no shame, but this is not your average situation. So many people are lonely, and I recognize it, and I've been there, and I want to help both those on the outside and those on the inside. And for somebody who recognizes that there's an issue on both sides of the wall, SE is it. That's where you need to be, because they are aiming to fix both of those situations.
Something that you just said that I think is really important is the notion of shame, because when we feel shame, that absolutely isolates us. It drives us inside. It makes us want to hide the thing from the world. And the consequences of that just compound one another. It's like the more isolated you are, the less you feel like you can reach out and get help, the more stress that you are putting on yourself. And there's also just something a bit odd about the notion that we should feel shame for someone else's actions to start with, or the consequences of their actions. You know, it's like, why do we take that on? And yet we do. So when you found yourself at SE doing that 9-week training, is that something that you specifically addressed in it? Because I just think shame is an incredibly destructive emotion most of the time, unless it drives us to do something differently and better. But in this circumstance, that's not possible because you didn't do anything wrong in the first place. So is that something that gets addressed?
So I want to say first that you said that it's a strange thing to be ashamed of somebody else's actions and somebody else's consequences. Just to piggyback on that, I just want to point out that we're in a time right now where people are becoming aware. There is a definite shift in this movement and in this time. There is an absolute shift. So you will hear so many people speaking about the unfairness, the injustice, the over-policing and mass incarceration of our Black and Brown brothers. But at the same time, if you are involved with, married to, brother and sister with, there's still that shame, even though we know that a lot of people know what's happening. And we're still so shameful, right?
Yeah.
So I just want to hit on that too. But to answer your question, yes, this is something that is absolutely talked about, because one of SE's main goals is to break isolation. Isolation comes from shame. So absolutely, this is something that is talked about a lot, especially in the healing circles that take place the first 9 weeks when you're in this cohort and getting to know your sisters and getting to know SE and really learning about yourself. And every time you're in a space where you're discussing mass incarceration and you're discussing advocacy, the talk is always about the people inside. Understandably, it's always about the people inside. SE is different in that they're also taking care of the people on the outside. This is our main talk, because how well can we be there for our incarcerated loved ones if we can't take care of ourselves? It's the airbag on the airplane scenario. I can't do for him if I can't take care of myself. So it's really genius, at the same time, very empathetic.
Mm-hmm. And something that you said also sparked this thought for me, which is, it doesn't matter whether your loved one is incarcerated for something they did or did not do. It doesn't matter. The shame is still there. The stigma is still there. The isolation and the problems are still there. And one of the problems that I think people don't recognize are the extraordinary costs associated with having a loved one incarcerated. I mean, you have attorney's fees, you have bond costs, or even something like phone calls. I don't think people realize how expensive a phone call from prison is. Those calls are collect. And they charge, I mean, the rate is ridiculous. I mean, So even something as simple as that, so that you can have a conversation with your loved one, becomes an obstacle. Also, there's lost income from the person who is incarcerated. And all of that puts so much pressure on the women outside. And you've touched briefly on Essie's program, which is called Healing to Advocacy. I'd love for you to tell us more about what that program does.
It's by nomination. So one of the Essie sisters who's already, you know, graduated will nominate people. And we're actually in our nomination phase right now, always looking to expand the membership and bring more people in. And, you know, the more people are in, the more people we're helping. So it's a 9-week program. You're nominated in. It's a circle of your sisters, but there's activities the entire time. So you come in and people will joke about the best part is the food. They just bring so much food. You bring your children with you. They have free babysitters. They're really holding up these women. Like, they're really upholding us and making sure that we're taken care of, because who wants to go to something for healing and, oh, I have the cost of babysitting with an incarcerated loved one. Little things like this are huge. I brought my son, he played with the other kids and he loved it. And it doesn't have to be a thing about, we're going to this thing about daddy being in prison. It's not that. He goes and he has fun. And while mommy's with her sisters and we talk and we do activities and we write and we become more aware of our own personal feelings that maybe you're not really looking at, and realizing that there's other people in this room, in this space, and outside of the space, a lot of people, they're going through the same thing. We get what's called a pause partner, and you're linked up. And at first you're like, oh God, this is so uncomfortable. I don't even know this person. It's not uncomfortable. It's having another sister there to, hey, how you doing? Send you a text and check on you. My pause partner was Faraha. I will never, ever forget that she was my pause partner and that she checked on me and that we text each other. And even not knowing somebody, it's a big deal to have someone check on you. And we're still friends today, and we always will be. I can't think of one Essie sister that I don't hope to be friends with for life. It is like a sorority without the hazing. You know, it's just a group of women that have a lot in common and nothing at all in common. It's amazing.
Yeah, that sounds like such an incredible space to create, because in that space, you walk in with all your differences, but there is this fundamental shared experience, and that creates the bridge. And from there, everything else is possible. And I love that model of things. And I love that that space is available to you and all of the women in your situation. And something that I was really interested when I was doing my research for this call was, Essie Justice says something that I believe so deeply in my bones, which is that women know what needs to change, and that we are the ones on the ground seeing the circumstances that need to change. And in this particular context, you are the ones on the ground seeing what needs to change. You know what the resources are that you need to be able to function well during and after the incarceration of a loved one. So could you talk about that a bit, about what you all see on the ground, what you believe needs to change, and how you're advocating for that?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's sad. It's useful, but sad that so many of us know this life so well and know what needs to be done. But we women just are naturally nurturers. It's just how it is. So we jump in and we want to get the work done, and we start researching and we start reaching out, and we jump in. The ones that are, you know, serious about advocating, jump in head first and do what needs to be done. And there's so much work all the time. And I always have some project going on at the time. At this moment, I'm working on a project to bring light to the parole board situation, their lack of grants. People are not being granted parole. And, you know, during COVID, I really thought that the number of grants was going to go up, and it didn't. Some months it actually went down a little bit. Something is fundamentally wrong with the border parole process. And so many people have been complaining about something being so wrong with it, including myself, and nobody's really doing anything about it. I don't want to go in great detail about what I'm doing right now, but I am taking a look at it. And that's just one of the projects I'm doing. But other things are, you know, these interviews, podcast interviews and radio interviews, they're important. It's really important to get the information out there. My personal opinion on mass incarceration and the policies that are holding people inside is that it definitely falls on us on the outside. I know that it's very easy to say that, you know, politicians, 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 and that's correct. But what drives the politicians to make the decisions that they make and push the bills that they push? It's us. They want to stay in office. I personally believe that it doesn't really matter if they're Democrat or Republican. That's not really a thing. The thing is, what are we saying on the outside? So we can sit in isolation and not say anything about what's going on and let people continue to believe what they believe about the carceral system, or we can do these interviews and we can write and we can speak up and we can tell you what's really going on. The information gets out there, the politicians hear it, and eventually they start to change these laws. In my opinion, that's how it needs to be done. I think that there's other loved ones of incarcerated people that feel the same way, and we're doing what we can to get the message out. But it's really important that people know that people are not being denied parole because they're breaking horrible laws. People are human and they make mistakes every single day. And people are being denied for things that aren't even an infraction out here in the real world. And it's not okay. The majority of people on the outside hear a denial of parole after someone's been inside for 15, 20, 25 years, and they think he's in there or she is in there fighting, doing drugs, doing something they're not supposed to do. When I've seen denials for things like covering the vent in their cell, which is a write-up, eating something that's not on their kosher or Muslim diet, them finding it on their commissary receipts. These are things people are getting denied for, not things that are illegal, not even things that are bad. And it's keeping them inside. And while we have an issue with the over-policing of our Black and brown men, we have an issue with the border parole not releasing people. There's people inside that are 70 plus years old. There's people inside. I know somebody personally that was denied parole in November. He turned 71 9 days after his parole board. He's been in for 33 years for a crime that I'm not really sure he committed. He has one leg that was amputated during his time inside because of an infection that wasn't looked at and properly treated. A double amputation at that, once above the knee, once below the knee, and then above the knee. He has a prosthetic leg, but they've never given him the physical training, the physical therapy that he needs to be able to use a prosthetic. This is 2013 we're talking about. He's still in a wheelchair designed for temporary movement. So now his rotator cuff is messed up because he's overextending his arms. He's lost part of his kidney from cancer. He has COPD. The list goes on. He's deaf in one ear. He was denied parole because he's deemed unfit for society, unsafe for society, based on the fact that they found a nudie pic under his mattress, something that probably every man out here does. And there was something else. I can't remember exactly what it was, but something else very small like this.
Right.
We're still keeping him inside.
Yeah.
You can guess what color he is.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, as you're going down the list of things, I mean, first off, the man is 70 something. So already that mitigates against him being any kind of threat outside in the world. You don't see a lot of 70 plus year olds going out and committing crimes. But it really does speak to the inequities in the system and just how the system is built to sustain itself. And I think that that's something that needs to be looked at and people need to pay attention to, because if for no other reason than that we are paying for this, we, the citizenry, are paying for this. So if you want to just put it at the most basic bottom line level, forget the humanity of it, we're paying for this. And maybe that will inspire people to make some effort towards change. And something I just want to add on to that is, in a conversation I had last week with someone, he pointed out that as few as 5 calls to your member of Congress can get them to take action on a bill that is otherwise going to go nowhere. they track these calls. So for everyone out there listening, if this is something that you feel passionate about, I really encourage you to reach out to your member of Congress and get your friends and colleagues to do the same, because it actually has more impact than we tend to think it does. So let me ask you, I want to shift gears a little bit here. There's been a really sharp rise in the numbers of women who are incarcerated. And I think when most people think of people in prison, they think it's mostly men, and it is still mostly men, but the differential is really shrinking. Right now, you're seeing a lot more women be incarcerated because criminal justice reform is making an impact on the number of incarcerated men. But meanwhile, women are being incarcerated at a higher rate. And Black women are twice as likely to be incarcerated as white women. And nearly half of Black transgender women are going to be incarcerated. And once in the system, there's an incredible risk of gender-based violence. What kind of work is SE doing to address these particular challenges?
So I'm glad that you asked this question. I was actually in a space yesterday where I was a panelist on a webinar, and one of the women in the audience spoke of the lack of advocacy around women that are incarcerated. And we know that there's so many women that are actually incarcerated for life without the possibility of parole for killing their abuser. And this is an issue, and it's mainly falls on the shoulders of Black women. So Essie's been involved in great things. I don't know if you've heard about the Black Mama Bailout on Mother's Day. There's been a couple of them, but they raised the funds to go and bail a Black mom out. And it's incredible to be a part of an organization that is not just holding up picket signs somewhere, you know, but actually getting the money together to go bail somebody out who, if they had more money, they wouldn't be sitting in jail, in the county jail, for who knows how long. And doing this work and being part of something that you know is just, you know, is so unjust. And you know that if this was, you know, a straight white man, he would be out, if not only for the fact that he probably just has more money, but also just based on what he looks like and how the world works. So I think that those kind of actions, on top of the fact that SE is very vocal about its inclusivity of women, transgender women, cis, it covers the entire, it's not just straight women, it's the entire package. And I'm really grateful for that, because I absolutely am very close to transgender advocacy work. It's very important to me. And something that my husband said to me, and I will never forget it as long as I live, one of the reasons I love him like I do, is he said to me maybe a month ago, I have respect, more respect for two groups of people that come into prison than any other groups. And that is the person that comes in by themselves with no affiliation to any type of group or gang, the young kid that comes in and refuses to get any type of protection. They do it on their own and keep their head high and keep moving. That's very scary. And transgender people, they are the most targeted, the most hurt, the most all of it. And he said, I have so much respect for them because they get it worse than any of us, from both sides, from the COs, as well as from the incarcerated people, because you have toxic masculinity. It's prison. So I have huge compassion for the transgender people that are incarcerated and not, but you know, it's very hard. And I have heard horrific stories and got involved in things that you don't know about until you get involved in advocacy. And it's scary and it's sad.
Yeah. These are things most of us really wish we did not have to think about, because they're painful and they're ugly and they're showing us the worst of humanity, not the best of humanity. And we'd really rather not live in that place, but here we are and we still have to do what we can do. And something you said led me to a thought that I had. Your organization wrote a report called Because She's Powerful. And in that report, this was what you said, and I'm quoting here. If Black mothers cannot feel pain, and if the connection between Black mother and child does not exist, breaking it cannot matter, not through death and not through incarceration. Mass incarceration follows in the tradition of slavery, which forcibly separated families, denied Black women's pain, and has its roots in early American jurisprudence, close quotes. And the thing that particularly struck me in that paragraph was the notion of denying Black women's humanity, essentially, and saying that Black women are outside of that experience of feeling deep attachment to their children, deep attachment to their partners. And so, you know, throwing a man in jail isn't going to impact his wife, isn't going to impact their Black children because Black people don't experience that. I mean, and I'm just curious as to what your experience of that mindset, for lack of a better phrase, is.
I have seen time and time again how our current carceral system is so synonymous with slavery. The things that are done, the separation of family, the humiliation, the trauma, the control. And I remember a couple of years ago, my husband got written up for something, and the first threat was, we're going to ship you off. We had just gotten married, and we hadn't even been married a year. And I live close to his facility. I'm about 40 minutes away. There is no closer facility than the one he is at. And if he gets shipped off, he could go down to San Diego. You know, he could go 8 hours away, go 6 hours away. So this was the very first threat. That is no different than how it was in the days of slavery. You got in trouble. You didn't listen. We're going to separate you from your wife and your kids. It's the emasculation of the Black man. I see it every day in a visit. I see someone literally stepping over a line and a CO saying, inmate, hey, inmate, and not giving them a name. It's definitely done on purpose. And racism is traditional. It's tradition. It's handed down from person to person. It's very rare that you have somebody that grows up around this tradition and doesn't pay it forward. It's very rare that somebody breaks free of that and says, wow, I grew up in this horrible family and I'm not going to do this. It is tradition. And tradition has not stopped. It has been handed down from generation to generation to generation, from hundreds of years ago, from 100 years ago to now. And not a lot has changed except for the way that it appears.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I think it's something that we really need to wrestle with. I mean, it shows up in so many ways, in Black maternal mortality rates and in just who gets bail, who doesn't get bail. And it's something that we really, really need to pay attention to.
Yeah, there are people, I've heard people myself blame the Black mortality rates of women giving birth on just the way we're made up, that it's just different. And no, we're not listened to. It's been handed down generation after generation that we don't feel pain the same way as a white woman, that we can go without an epidural or these things that, you know, that people usually opt for, that it's not a big deal. I didn't see it at the time because I was only 22 years old when I had my first child. They wouldn't give me an epidural. And they told me it was because I had this back injury and he wasn't exactly sure where it was. I found out later that wasn't true. And I have to wonder if I was a different color, if I would have gotten that epidural.
Right. And just that you have to wonder that is so disheartening, and it's exhausting, frankly. I mean, it's just exhausting having to fight that fight every single day, and yet it is what is necessary, so we keep doing it. So let me ask you this question. When you think of the carceral system, what's the future that you would like to see?
Oh, yes. I love this question because I am an abolitionist, and when people hear that, they run. They think I'm crazy, and I'm not. When I say that I want to abolish the system, that means I want to abolish the current carceral system in the United States. The current carceral system in the United States does not work. The current carceral system is not going to be fixed through reform. It has to be completely abolished. Let's start over again. Let's just start from scratch. There's a system that works. This isn't it. And that's what I mean by abolishing it. Let's find a better way to do this. People that are hurt, hurt people. And these are the people that are ended up in prison. So instead of meeting these people with harm and hatred and more trauma, let's meet them with love and see what happens. And I know that sounds crazy to some people, but before those people jump on me being, you know, a snowflake or whatever else, let's take a look at other countries that are doing this. We know what other countries are doing. CDCR knows what other countries are doing. They see how successfully Scandinavian countries are running their carceral system, how humane it is, and how successful it is. These correctional officers are engaging with the incarcerated people. They're not beating them and screaming at them. They're sitting down with meals, for meals with them. They're engaging and they're talking and they're playing volleyball with them and card games, sitting next to them. They're not above them. They're their peers and they're getting met with love and understanding. They're sitting in groups with them. They're listening to their issues and talking about their own. There's a give and take. There's very, very rarely any outbreaks of violence in these prison systems. We know this and we're not even trying to do it. Why?
That's a really good question. And I don't have an answer for that, but I'm going to have to really think about this, because when you know something does not work, why do you keep doing it? And the evidence that this doesn't work is abundant. So we definitely need to change things, and how we change them is a conversation that I think is really important to have. Our time is almost up, and I want to make sure that I get from you three things that our listeners can do to make a difference in this incredibly important area. What are three things you would have them do?
Absolutely. And I just want to say that I am just an average wife, average person. Anybody can get involved in this work. You don't need anything special. I think the three main things are learn the message and push the message, whether it's social media, telling your friends, telling your family. We have to get more people to understand what's happening in these systems and get more people on board in order to change the minds and the laws through legislation. So that's one. Call your local and statewide organizations. Go down a list of all of them. See which values align with yours the most and call them. See what you can do. Even if you can't give your time, if you can donate some money, all of these nonprofits need help with funding, all of them. They're never going to say no to that. But on the flip side of that, right now, donating your time, like so much stuff is being done from home. So I would see how you can do that. A lot of the stuff that I do is making calls, sending emails. I have no problem calling, emailing a legislator, by the way. That, look them up, send them an email. The worst they're going to do is not respond to you. Oh, well. But yes, write to your legislation. And the third thing is check on your wives and your sisters and your moms of people that have somebody inside. It's really important. It's very important that this isolation is broke. And not everybody has an SC justice group like I do. Not everybody's lucky enough to have that. And it is extremely lonely. Just call and check on them. How you doing? And let them know you're thinking about them.
Thank you. Those are really great and really important. I think that people often don't realize that they're probably only a few degrees separated from someone who is incarcerated. So to pay attention to that and to actually hold up those people who are directly impacted by that experience is really important.
Yes,
Alicia, definitely. This was amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yes,
thank you. I really appreciate that you took the time to have this conversation. And we're going to keep talking about this because it's super important.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to use your platform to get the message out. I appreciate this anytime I'm able to do this.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening. This is such a critical issue, yet one that lives outside of most people's awareness. If you found this conversation as compelling as I did, please do share it in your networks. At the end of each episode, I say these words, which feel even more relevant right now. Change starts with story, so keep sharing yours.
I'll be back with another episode of Stepping into Truth very soon.